May I invite the speakers to come to the front, and Dinah will conduct the discussion section.
Thanks very much indeed. What I'm going to do is to first of all give you my slightly eclectic version of what I've learned, and then I will let you loose on the speakers. But it is my duty to give not really a summary, but more of an observation on what has been offered to us. Professor Oshag gives us a very interesting view of the world. As an agronomist, I didn't recognize so much of it. It is important that we have the rules in place, but the issue for me is how well are the rules being applied. And even if the definitions say that adequate food is available, I don't know what adequate means, and I know that when you translate that into different languages, it means very different things. But I think the critical thing for me that came out of what he was saying is the need for promotion. Because if we just have these laws, these morals, these ethics on the books, it doesn't mean anything unless they actually get out. And for me, what linked his paper with Barbara's was the issue of whistleblowing. You know, I don't care if we have a billion, 900,000, 1.5 billion malnourished and hungry people. I care if we have just a single one. I think it's interesting that we just had the business of the miners in Chile, that the whole world was concerned by the fate of a few people. And yet at the same time, we are unconcerned, perhaps, with the fate of a billion malnourished children. And I think that that creates a difficulty. Our humanness is called into question as far as that is concerned. And the very fact that we are far off our Millennium Development Goal targets is an obscenity, and we should recognize that in this particular conference. And I'm thankful to Barbara for this now important understanding that malnourishment does not only include hunger and lack of vitamins, but also can be excess carbohydrates and the malnourishment that comes with that because of the very critical problem of type 2 diabetes and other things that excess carbohydrate and obesity brings. And I also am happy that she drew attention to the issue of biodiversity. But biodiversity, we need to understand, is of little value unless it's actually used. And the means to use that biodiversity is quite problematic and expensive. And it's no surprise for me to learn that the sweet potato variety that's being touted around is in fact the one that doesn't necessarily have huge amounts of vitamin A in it. And I think that's true with a whole range of different crops and something that we need to take on board. And for Professor Perez Escamilla's talk, I'm extremely pleased that there is data available. And it strikes me that you can do these small household type surveys and to generate good generic results. I know how expensive and how time consuming that is because I've been involved in those sorts of things myself. But the comparison of rural and urban households between countries and all the rest of it is really quite problematic as far as I'm concerned. If we have some sort of generic tool now, that's fine. But my difficulty, particularly as the DG of the World Vegetable Center, is to learn that as soon as people become food insecure, vegetables and fruits go off the list. And I believe that's a clear understanding. But my interpretation of this is that, in fact, fruits and vegetables are too expensive. Their growing seasons are too short, they're seasonal, etc., etc. And that's one of the things that we can do something about if only we could invest more money in that type of research. And I am concerned, I think, in the final analysis, that though we now have an elegant tool for measuring food insecurity, it's not doing anything about it. It's a little bit like the global warming people. We seem to have thousands of people working on whether the global warming exists and defining global warming and being concerned about global warming, but almost nobody doing anything about it. Okay, I'm very much into the do it about it category, and if we have a food insecurity tool, then I want to have ways in which that food insecurity can be overcome and can be overcome rapidly. Thank you very much. The floor is now open for questions. Please apologize for my rather egocentric view of these papers.
Thank you.
Who would like to go first? Please.
Good morning. My name is Gordon Bacon. I work with Pulse Canada. We're a national organization that looks at representing the growers and traders of peas, beans, lentils, and chickpeas. So my comment, Barbara, was to you. It's more of a question because I was left not certain what message you were delivering with one slide you went over very quickly. I think the measurements of biodiversity and sustainability are very important, and we're working with a lot of the commercial food sector to define what sustainability is and what our targets need to be. So I was a bit puzzled by the slide that you had that was talking about elements which are not part of sustainable or biodiverse, part of a survey you're doing for an upcoming conference. And there was a comment about agricultural chemicals, and I was just wondering if you would provide some additional comment on that.
Should I answer now? Or you can you hear me? Hello. Okay. This survey looks at, as I said, what should be excluded from the concept of sustainable diets. And there are a series of questions, and one is high agricultural chemical use, without specifying, but including in most people's minds, fertilizers, herbicides, insecticides, et cetera, a whole range of agricultural chemicals. And the respondents overwhelmingly indicated that that kind of agriculture is not sustainable as it is practiced now, and thus should not be part of the concept, thus should be specifically excluded from the concept of sustainable diets. It wasn't the only thing. It included monoculture, agriculture, intensive livestock industries, and several other things. We did have some comments on that survey from one or two people who said it looked like we were seeking input from activists and leading them into certain answers, but we are not. It's an open survey. People have to identify their profession and their interest in responding to this. But it's basically, I think, a lot of people who are interested in organic agriculture, among other things, are the ones now become a dominant force in nutrition and agriculture, at least among the survey respondents.
Just one last comment. I have real concerns about looking at process metrics. I really think we need to focus on outcome metrics and measuring what matters. And I don't know that processes give us meaningful measurements of goals and targets that we need to push to.
Thank you for that comment. Next question, please. Yes.
Yes, I have a question for Raphael. Might be a little technical, but I didn't get how you validated the food insecurity scale. Did you validate it against what is your gold standard? Is this indicator supposed to predict calorie intake or dietary diversity? And if so, what kind of data did you have to validate it? Also, it seems to me that, and I didn't get the exact number, but it seems to me that the indicator has a whole lot of questions, like 15 or 16. That will make it much more difficult to use. And you did mention it is being used in the DHS surveys, but we're having real trouble getting that many questions in DHS surveys in most countries, and certainly in Africa. So is there a way to reduce the number of questions? Are they all useful? Can we come up with a simpler tool? And my understanding is that actually FANTA does have a much simpler tool that has been validated in many countries around the world. So I'm not sure how the two compare. And so.
Could I just identify the speaker? That was Dr. Mary Royal from IFPRI.
Yes. So I'll start with your last question first. In terms of shortening, first of all, we use a filter in national applications. So the four household level items go first. If they answer no to those four, that's it. The chances that they're going to say yes to any of the following one is very, very small. Secondly, a second filter is related to the presence or absence of individuals under 18 years of age. So in most Latin American countries, you end up applying the full scale only to about half of the sample. We have considered the request to develop a sample with less items. It is a very tricky situation because you know the process that takes and the different applications that those short scales are designed for, mostly for monitoring systems like CISBAN and so on. In terms of the validation of the scale, mostly it has been against a socioeconomic and dietary quality type of indicators, fruits, vegetables, animal protein sources, and those come out consistently in many different settings as correlating very nicely with the food insecurity levels in the household. So that has been the standard that has been used. And regarding FANTA, I would urge all of you to read the latest report that FAO has released related to the validity of the scale for cross-cultural use. They have dropped now from 9 to 3 items. So I think it is a topic that it would take me much longer to address here, but I will be happy to do so during the break.
We have time for two more quick questions. Only make them quick and make them two only. Madam, you're next.
Hi, my name is Marion. I'm a master's student in sociology, and my research focuses on the food crisis, particularly local and women-led responses to the food crisis. So I just wanted to thank Dr. Burlingham for having given a really enlightening view of how complex the situation is with the focus on biodiversity, because too often the focus is on enhancing technological inputs and making them accessible, disregarding the fact that the problem is really rooted in food distribution and not enhancing food productivity. In fact, technology has really eroded a lot of communities and propagated an epidemic of farmer suicides in India, which is where my research is focused. My question to you is, you mentioned how Europe has tried to balance biotechnology and biofuels with biodiversity and ecosystems with a focus on local food systems and traditional food systems, validating farmer knowledge, which is often disregarded in a well-intentioned but misdirected emphasis on technology. Do you foresee any, I know like the speaker who preceded you was talking about a PhD on TRIPS in the World Trade Organization. Do you foresee this priority being expanded to other countries? We're also going to be validating both traditional forms of agriculture and also technology?
I do.
Yes.
Was that quick enough? But maybe we can. I can give you more detail afterwards. But we're optimistic, and the whole concept of conservation through sustainable use is dominating this whole theme, and most countries recognize that continuing the degradation of environments and the loss of biodiversity is really crippling them, and the quick fix solutions to the problems of malnutrition are creating a lot of, well, unintended consequences, as they always have.
Thank you.
Fine, we have one more question.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Sherry Arnott, and I'm with World Vision Canada. I would like to ask each of the panelists for some advice for an organization that does agriculture and food security programming and policy. From your research, what would be a piece of advice that you would give an organization like us?
I'm going to let Professor Oshag answer this question.
How easy. It's a very complex and difficult question. I'm sure that is why you ask it. So I don't have a good answer for you. But what I know is that those most keen on the right to food, if I should address that, are the NGOs. They say this is how we can hold politicians accountable. And a lot of things have happened since 1996, when we got the breakthrough in the World Food Summit. So what I think is very important for you is to document whatever is happening so that you can contribute to the evidence base and do it well. Do it together with specialists so that you're sure that not somebody could come and shoot it down. That is probably the most important thing. And also to think about the diversity, the inequality between different people, you know, how powerful they are, who are getting the most to say in those things. I think that is very important as well, to document that again, to show that this actually has an impact. Then it's a question of, well, how much is done? The chair asked me about that. It seems that we sort of have a lot to say, but nothing is done. Well, I would say that from my area, when it comes to the right to adequate food, a lot has happened. And now the driving force of many of those processes are the NGOs, and I think thereby that we are on a quite good way of doing it. Governments doesn't like to be accountable for what they do. They like it if it can promote them. Private sector is much more engaged in ethics. Fine. But on what ground? Is it just when you want to do it? So the human rights addresses something that that people in the government must do. The sector, the private sector also must do that. And I know many are doing it, but many others are not. Adequacy. You asked, what does adequacy mean? Well, I think that nutrition comes in there, because adequate food means adequate for human being. Foods as part of a diet, so actually the word diet should be there. It's coming a little longer down in the definition of Harriet. But it's very important that it means actually that is where nutrition comes in. And in the Article 11.2, nutrition as a word is used.
Very good. On that optimistic note, I think we should attend to our own well-balanced nutrition and diet, as it's now coffee time. Unfortunately, there aren't too many fruit and vegetables on display, but I'm sure there's something. Thank you very much indeed, and thank all the speakers.